Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hi, Mona. Hi, Rebecca. Glad to have you both back.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark. It's great to be back in the States.
So, Mark, we're going to jump straight into this because we don't have too much time, as you know, and we have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. But this particular episode is really aimed at the people who are in the United States on a non-immigrant business visa like H-1Bs who want to do EB-5.
Yeah, and Mona, I must say that I'm really glad that we're devoting an entire episode to these issues that is so topical right now.
That's right. In fact, Mark, both of us have been attending local seminars. I'm saying local, I mean local as in the United States.
That's local for you.
I mean, Rebecca, you were just in Chicago on an issue like this, right?
Yeah. So we've been attending seminars in Chicago, New Jersey. In today's podcast, we hope to have all those answers to your questions.
Yeah, these are quite well-attended seminars, actually. It's very interesting because there's a lot of people, and I think every EB-5 project is experiencing the influx of people who are on H-1Bs and other visas looking at EB-5.
Yeah, exactly. So we've seen quite a few majority H-1B holders, but we've seen their, you know, L-1s, E-2s, who are looking at EB-5 as their next option.
Right. But the issue is that especially for an H-1B holder, there are certain rules and regulations that many are not aware of. And as I say, these are questions which have been brought up to us time and time again. So we thought we would answer them.
This sounds great. Obviously, you've done a few seminars on this. A lot of people show up because, as Rebecca mentioned, there's the E2s, the L1. Of course, we're talking about the H-1B in this episode, these non-immigrant visas. And people are looking to do an immigrant visa like the EB-5. And you get a lot of questions. So I'm happy to discuss this with you on this episode, because really, we're getting the highlight of the common questions that keep coming up. And all these, well, what you call these local seminars, local to the U.S., you know, Chicago, New Jersey, all over the place.
Yeah, right. We actually have one coming up in Texas soon also.
Mm-hmm. Still local.
Well, it is if you compare it to Shanghai.
True.
Okay, so I think we should start, Rebecca, with an area that we have found that many immigration lawyers or practitioners really don't understand. And it's interesting, there's a lot of immigration lawyers who are also attending these seminars. And anything really related with SEC, I think, goes over the heads of a lot.
Yeah, you're really correct on that part, Mona. With anyone who is in the U.S. who is filing an EB-5 petition, especially through a securities-related offering, such as if you're going through a project with a regional center or even a direct pool project, you have to be what's called an accredited investor.
Right. Well, the first thing is that people don't really understand what you mean by a securities-related offering. So we try to simplify this. And so basically, I've advised attorneys, is there a PPM? If there's a PPM, that's a securities offering.
And for those, a PPM is a private placement memorandum. So,
Rebecca, let's start with the basics. What is an accredited investor?
Okay, so there's three ways to become an accredited investor. One, if you're an individual person, you have to have an earning of $200,000 or more for 2 years in a row. Or if you have you and a spouse earning more than $300,000 2 years in a row. The other way in which we find most of our clients actually have the last way, which is having $1 million in assets. Now, the $1 million in assets can be, you know, any assets you have around the world. It's not just to the U.S. It could be India, China, Taiwan, any country that you have assets that equal to $1 million.
Yeah, but why does somebody have to be an accredited investor? That question comes up over and over again. And the answer really to that is it's when anybody has a securities offering, when the regional centers have a security offering, they rely on certain regulations or certain exemptions rather. And one of the exemptions that they rely on if they are getting an investor locally is Regulation D. And in order to bring somebody into their project, under Regulation D, they have to be an accredited investor.
So Mona, as you said earlier, you know, immigration is a completely separate topic from SEC. So will USCIS question an investor on accredited investor?
Well, that's interesting because I've just explained it's a securities issue. So why would USCIS ask? Previously, USCIS would not ask securities questions. And that's really been the pattern. But recently, there has been a change. And I think it was one of the events that we were at, Rebecca, I remember on a panel you hosted, you actually mentioned that there are RFEs coming in asking, is the investor accredited?
Exactly. And then that's where we had a really nice debate on whether or not USCIS was overstepping. You know, they're supposed to be looking at immigration issues, and here they are overstepping and going into SEC issues. With that, you know, you have to just argue, but if I'm not an accredited investor, what can I do, Mona?
Well, if you're not an accredited investor and you're already in a project, that's a different scenario.
Yeah.
If you know that you're not an accredited investor, if you know you just cannot meet the threshold, you haven't got $1 million, net worth of $1 million, even with overseas property, that you have not got that income, you really should not be going into a project where you see a PPM and offering documents. You can certainly still do EB-5. But you can do EB-5 as a part of a direct pool project or an entrepreneurial project, and a direct pool project where you're a manager and you have maybe an equity ownership.
So would I be able to own my own company on an H-1B though? Would I be able to do my own EB-5 project?
You mean if you're not an accredited investor,
yes.
So therefore how do you? Well, another interesting point, because a lot of H-1B holders I worry about this, because with an H-1B, you have to basically be working X amount of hours, usually more than full-time hours with your company just to be able to maintain your H-1. But there are two answers to that. Number one, an H-1B person can hold their own company, and they can even be an H-1B holder within the company that they own. But there's a lots of rules and regulations to that. It was more complicated before 2010, and I think it was 2010, Rebecca, when USCIS came out with a memorandum.
Yes, yes. So it allowed you to starting your own business, but there was so many rules and regulations within that.
For example, the applicant could not be the sole proprietor of their own business. They could not set the business up just to create an H-1.
So basically, you have to be an employee. You still have to show that you're an employee of the business.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if it's an EB-5 related business, then you cannot obviously be counted as any of the workers. Mm-hmm. But it has been done. So another issue which really does come up a lot with H-1B, and we find this is very common, is that an H-1B holder will have his H-1B from a company, maybe it's a small company, and then he wants to put the $500,000 back into that same existing company. And this is pretty common. We see this pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So the main issue with that is the fact that it's an existing business. So where the rules with an existing business are a little different.
Yeah. So the problem with you have to be careful with EB-5, because with existing companies, you have to show, you know, what are you using the money for? And are you creating new jobs?
Right. So with an existing business, if that it already has a bunch of employees, mm-hmm. you can't count any of those employees. It has to be new employees created through your investment.
Exactly. And they have to be U.S. workers, too. So you can't include H-1B workers within that 10 jobs.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right.
And also with this scenario, again, we're finding with H-1B people is that where it really falls down is they don't know what to spend their money on, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It's not that easy to spend $500,000, especially on an existing business.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if it's up and running and doing very well, what more can you do?
Yeah.
So
another issue with relation to H-1B holders, which we get asked all the time, is because there's a lot of H-1B holders who want to apply for EB-5, but they already have an approved I-140, or they're applying for an I-140, and they worry whether or not they will lose their I-140, which they may have waited for a number of years. And this applies really to, I would say, Chinese and Indian applicants.
Yeah.
Because right now, Indian applicants have, under the EB-2 and EB-3 category, they have a very long wait.
Yeah. And those wait times are, it's becoming years right now for China. These, you know, wait times, it's not as long as India. There's still about, you know, 3 or 4 years of wait time, you know, 2015, 2014, but India is all the way back to 2009. And the visa bulletin, you know, it moved forward a bit, but not as much. So there's still a lot of waiting time. So what do you do? Can I go ahead and file my EB-5 application while my I-140 is either pending or approved?
We should actually explain what an I-140 is, by the way, which is your labor certification.
Yes.
Under an EB-2 is your skilled worker and EB-3 is your unskilled worker.
Exactly. It's another immigrant petition. So you are filing for your green card, but you are allowed to file simultaneously multiple applications for a green card. So you can have your I-140 pending or it's approved and you're waiting for your priority date. At the same time, you can have your EB-5 petition pending as well.
And the other big question, Rebecca, is that I get my I-526, which is my approval for the EB-5. And I still don't have my final conditional green card, and I really don't know if the project is going to create all the jobs, and I will have that. Can I still hold on to my I-140 because I'm going to have a conditional green card?
Yes, yes. So that's a huge question we get asked by a lot of investors. So I always say it's a backup to a backup. So you filed your I-140. It's a way of getting your green card. Unfortunately, you have to wait 8+ years before you can get a green card. You get your I-526. You get your green card through that. Unfortunately, it's a conditional green card. So within the next 2 years, what if something happens and you happen to lose that conditional green card? Luckily enough, we can go back and actually reinstate your I-140 petition and you can go ahead and get your green card through that path.
Well, do we reinstate it? I don't know if it's not actually reinstated as such.
Yeah, it's not as such, but at least you would notify USCIS that this is the path you're going through now. And then that way we can follow on.
And there's other questions which keep being asked in the different scenarios, Mark, Rebecca. One question which we get asked consistently is, well, what if my I-140 gets approved around about the same time as my EB-5 and I want to pull out, can I get my investment money back? That's a huge one because that really is project to project. And technically, you really can't withdraw once you have filed your EB-5. You can withdraw your EB-5 petition, but getting your money back is a different story.
Yeah, you're then putting, you know, other investors in jeopardy because then there's a question as whether or not the funds are at risk. Because if you can withdraw at any time and get your money back from a project, then are you really at risk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other issue is, will a project be able to give you your money back at that stage? Because if, for example, it's a real estate project, they've used all your funds in constructing, they aren't going to pay you back until they're ready to pay back. So that is another issue that people who are on H-1Bs with a pending I-140 have to really consider. The type of project that they go into, does it have the ability to pay back early? Do I want to pay back early? Could I negotiate perhaps more interest? There's nothing wrong with doing that. Certainly, USCIS like to see EB-5 people making money. They don't mm-hmm. like to see EB-5 people not getting anything out of their investment. So there are different scenarios or different ways of perhaps dealing with the situation.
And that's where I think you need a good attorney who understands the entire H-1B process, you know, the non-immigrant side of it, but someone who also understands the EB-5 process and obviously understanding project details as well, because that person will be able to guide you along and say, okay, is it really worth it for me to apply for EB-5? If I'm only, you know, 2 years waiting in line, should I apply for it? Should I not? Will I lose my money? Will I get my money back? And, you know, these are questions that you need to ask your attorney and make sure that they're knowledgeable in all sections of this immigration.
Well, not just your attorney, Rebecca. I would think that it would be important to really understand the project and make sure if you don't, your attorney doesn't understand the project that you do.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue that we are finding a lot of is, again, a lot of H-1B people who are coming in on a project, in a project which perhaps has a number of Chinese investors. Now, Chinese investors are subject to retrogression and backlogs, and the Indian investor at this point is not. Do they get their money back before the Chinese investor? Can the project redeploy? Is there a possibility of a different interest rate?
Yeah, there's so many questions that you have to ask above and beyond just your typical, you know, can I file my EB-5 with my I-140 petition pending?
Yeah, but if we have a rule of thumb, I think usually you'll see that most attorneys who are project attorneys are pretty consistent that they like to see uniform offerings. You can have a rider and you can have changes, small changes, but on the whole, they don't like to see large changes because that can hurt the project documents. You can, USCIS can come back and say, well, wait a minute. We, you know, we don't see a consistency here and stuff. And therefore, are other people informed? Because as an offering, one of the most important things is that there's disclosure. So if one investor is perhaps getting 8% and another investor is getting 0.5%, is that a disclosurable issue?
Yeah. And I think that brings us to our next topic is, you know, making sure you have an attorney, like we said, that understands all this, because we've seen, and I think USCIS has seen this too, is a lot of bad lawyering out there. You know, petitions are just being filed without the proper documentations. And I think it's important for these H-1B holders to have an attorney who knows what they're doing, especially when it comes to filing their source of funds documents and understanding these project documents.
Well, this has really taken the limelight this week. Mark, I don't know if you were aware, but everybody was bowled over a few days ago when there was a policy memo which was just released by USCIS, which said that in certain cases, if they don't believe there's enough evidence for a case to go through, they are not going to bother with an RFE or even annoyed a notice of intention to deny, and they will deny the case outright.
No RFE, no annoyed, no notice of intent to deny, just a straight denial.
A straight denial.
And this is on the discretion of the officer. So we have to be absolutely careful now, you know, when we're filing cases for these investors. Getting it right the first time.
Yeah. And Rebecca, that kind of goes to your point of having an attorney that really understands these issues, not just of EB-5 and H-1B, but also of these overlaps and differences and possible discrepancies. Mona, Rebecca, if you don't mind, let me ask you both a question that, well, I often ask on another legal podcast I host. What should people be looking for in an attorney to represent them in these types of cases?
That's a huge question, Mark. Obviously, experience matters. The big issue here is that if an attorney has not done EB-5 before and really doesn't understand what they're doing, the real danger is a case getting rejected. It's not just the fact that a case gets rejected, but a person can refile. It's the fact that right now, in this current time, if you don't get it right first time, what you are subjecting your client to is a possible increase, because we are still going to be getting this increase in the 500, as well as being part of the potential backlog. And if you don't do enough EB-5 and this is shabby lawyering, you're opening yourself up to a malpractice suit.
Exactly.
And what I'm also hearing, it's not so much finding an attorney that knows EB-5, but also knows this overlap between H-1B and EB-5. And Rebecca, as you mentioned before, having a backup to a backup, if you get your initial EB-5, your I-526, your conditional green card, but for whatever reason, could probably, most likely, be outside of the foreign investor's control, they're unable to get those conditions removed, then they can go back to that I-140. Mm-hmm. But honestly, that is just crazy complex in my head. I can't even, it just sounds really hard to do. So that might be something that somebody would ask of their attorney. Not only have you done EB-5s, but I'm on this H-1B. What is your plan B or your plan C? Or as Rebecca says, your backup to a backup, because there's lots of risks, especially now that they are, it's up to the officer's discretion. They can just deny without a request for evidence, without a notice of intent to deny. Just like, deny, you know, move to the next in line. Oh my goodness.
And what's important too is they also came out with, you know, as soon as you're denied a petition, if you're not on non-immigrant visa or any type of visa, then they can automatically put you into removal.
Right. But we have to remember at this point, though, EB-5 does not give you a right to stay in the country.
Yes.
It's not a concurrent filing yet. That was brought up previously, and we do expect that, you know, USCIS are going to allow it in the future at some point, but not right now. So if your case gets denied and your H-1 is okay, then, you know,
you'll be okay.
All right. But at the same time, as I say, if your case gets denied right now, it could mean that you would be subject to an increase in the minimum amount and the potential backlog if you're from one of the countries which is looking at being backlogged early next year. Other questions which arise with H-1B, Rebecca, tend to be a certain type of source of funds issues.
Yes, yes. We get a lot of those questions. So with our H-1B clients, because a lot of them, obviously, they're here in the U.S., we tend to see that a lot of them, they end up tending to have multiple sources, which can, you know, sometimes if it's not, again, this goes back to the lawyering, if you don't have someone who is able to put in all the documents related to each of your sources, that can hurt you. And then a lot of times too, the officers don't like to see multiple sources. It just means that there's more documents for them to go through.
There have been a number of cases where the H-1B holder has relied on income they've earned here in the United States. And of course, the first thing that USCIS are going to do is see that income has been lawfully earned. Now, if somebody's not familiar with everything which goes on in all of these issues, they'll be like, oh yes, they had this little store and they, of course, that income was lawfully earned. But that store was run by the H-1B holder's wife who actually didn't have an EAD. Is that means that it was that lawfully earned? So there are issues that you have to look at.
And many issues that you have to go through. One of the major issues that we're seeing, and you know, Mona and I have seen this a lot, is that we're seeing the H-1B holders getting more and more gifts. And not only gifts from family members, but non-family members.
Right. This is really crucial because in the last legislation drafts, and as you know, Mark, we are part of the public policy committee, so we actually reviewed a lot of the draft legislation. One of the big issues in the draft legislation was the fact that gifts were being limited only to immediate family members. Because if you have a gift from a friend, for example, is that a real true gift to the friend? Are you going to pay that back? Is that friend really going to gift it to you? No, most of the time it's a loan from a friend. But a loan would get denied if you didn't have collateral.
Exactly.
So we are seeing too many gifts from distant friends, friends who would probably not give you $100,000. I mean, that's a great friend, you know, it's a gift of $100,000 or $200,000.
Yeah.
And I really wouldn't be surprised if USCIS come up out of the blue with a policy memorandum saying that, you know, severely limiting gifts.
Yeah. And we've seen that in the past. USCIS can retroactively come back. And if they put this new policy in, we could potentially see a lot of denials moving forward. So you need to be careful with moving forward with gifts, especially from, you know, friends or those who are not immediate family members. And what we've seen, our dilemma is either getting huge amounts from friends, like Mona said, $100,000, $200,000. Would a friend really gift you that much? Or then you're going to end up having multiple friends gifting at $50,000 or less. So then you end up with the multiple source issue.
And I think that's where the RFE about accredited investor comes in. So that if somebody is going in and if they have 30 gifts from friends, are they really an accredited investor?
Exactly. Exactly. And the whole EB-5 is an entrepreneurial visa. So that's what they're actually looking for.
Yeah, this is getting so complicated, Mark. I know.
It is. And I want to ask one question. Well, how does that affect transfers out of China? Because I think you're limited to, what, $50,000 per person per year. And I believe the current workaround is to have, you know, 10 people transfer you $50,000. And if your family's not big enough, maybe you're leaning or looking at friends to transfer things for you. How does that work with the Chinese transfer limits and the source of funds?
Well, first of all, Mark, we are referring to local people. This whole episode really was aimed at H-1B holders.
All right, let's forget I even asked that question.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what I can say is that a lot of our clients, because they are local, they have assets outside of the U.S., but unfortunately, it takes time for them to liquidate. Or, you know, it's hard to sell a property, get a loan. You have to actually go to India in order for you to get a loan. You have to be physically there. Or, you know, India is giving a lot of issues now too. The RBI, you know, if you're trying to get a loan from a property.
RBI being Royal Bank of India.
Yes. You're not allowed to, you can't transfer your funds for investment purposes outside of India. So, you know, there's a lot of issues going on within India. And so that's why a lot of our clients are having issues. And that's why they're going after these loans from friends or a gift from friends. So there's some issues going on there. And we had one client, I mean, we took half an hour and we went all the way around for his source of funds issues. You know, his father couldn't get a loan.
We considered like 16 different scenarios.
Yeah. And they said his father was too old to get a loan. And if he gets a loan, he can't, you know, take it out. So, you know, those are all the issues that we have to deal with. And you have to be on top of it as the attorney.
Right. So with H-1B holders, it's not only just the project documents and the projects and the position with the project and their current current position mm-hmm. within the United States and what job they're doing and their source of funds. There are multiple issues that have to be looked at. Again, shabby lawyering is crucial at this point.
Yeah, yeah. We've had recently a client come in who absolutely had no documents related to his source of funds. With the new policy memo, that would have definitely gone denied.
Yeah.
We've seen clients, you know, wiring funds from the wrong accounts, whether it's, coming from business accounts versus personal accounts.
Well, that happens with the entrepreneurial projects a lot. There's a lot of mistakes that you can make. And the other thing is with someone who's local, as opposed to overseas, is that locally you have access to things like credit mm-hmm. cards. So then you will have clients coming in with credit card money from credit cards. Again, all of these points are issues. They're huge, huge red flags mm-hmm. for USCIS for their actual potential approvals for the source of funds.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, don't worry. We've worked them out somehow.
Mona, Rebecca, let me ask you this. If I'm already sponsored by my company, I have an I-140. I'm legally working here in the U.S. and I possibly 8 years down the road could get my green card. What's the advantages of doing EB-5 now? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of complexity, a lot of things to be on the lookout, but what are the advantages of going the EB-5 route versus staying the course with my H-1B?
Oh, plenty. There's lots. There's a reason why there is a lot of people who are doing, who are interested in EB-5, Mark. One of the main issues right now is that if you have an I-140 filed and you're from India or even from China, but I think India is the worst right now, it could potentially be a 20-25 year wait. Right now, India is at 2009 and it hasn't moved more than a couple of weeks. In fact, it's gone back at times. So it is a long, long wait.
Mm-hmm. And then with the H-1B, we've seen a lot of uncertainty in that area, especially with this administration that we're mm-hmm. with now.
Yeah. Well, that's being nice. This administration's been a disaster for H-1B, yeah. Rebecca. I think really, let's just put it out as it is.
Yeah.
Under the Obama administration, a spouse was entitled to get an EAD, which is a work visa. This administration, unfortunately, has a completely different policy. They believe in hire Americans, stay American. And they have already decided to terminate EAD holders for spouses.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't understand, you know, how much money they actually do bring into the country. But with these applications, you know, more and more, we see more scrutiny. I know a lot of H-1B holders have seen that. They're not giving deference to already approved petitions. So if you're filing for
RFEs,
an extension.
Huge RFEs on H-1B holders. So they're not necessarily automatically getting their extensions. Mm-hmm. And if they have a child, for example, who's about to age mm-hmm. out, then there's another issue for them.
Yeah, so you have to be very careful. And then on top of that, you know, with those who are already here on the H-1B, if even to get an H-1B in the first place is hard enough, it's difficult.
With the amount of petitions filed, mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. And as far as filing for EB-5, Mark, one of the big things is right now, there's no backlog for India right now. We don't know what it would be like next year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it's still at 500,000, which is relatively doable from many, many people.
Yeah. And I think I know a lot of clients of mine that come to us, one of the major advantages that they like is that they can obtain the EAD once they're approved, after their I-526 is approved and they're going through the I-45 stage, you do get that EAD within 90 days. And they all love having that because then they're able to, you know, start their own company or, you know, just do more things with the EAD rather than being on the H-1B.
Yeah, it's a security. It's a security mm-hmm. of having an immigrant visa as opposed to a non-immigrant mm-hmm. visa.
Right. And another aspect of that security is you're not tied to your H-1B sponsor, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. So no slave labor.
Exactly. Exactly. So one last point I want to make is what's also interesting, you know, we're talking about I-140s, we're talking about H-1Bs, but what we don't realize either is that the current administration is attempting to restrict practical training for those who have just finished their university. So OPT for students could also be something that they're looking at. So I would say the EB-5 is the best way to go at this moment.
Well, Mona, Rebecca, thank you. That was obviously a lot of information, and I can tell that you've covered this before many times as a result of all these common questions that you're getting from going from location to location, place to place, talking about H-1B and EB-5. And from what I get from this, the highlight is stay away from shabby lawyering. This self-serving message brought to you by Mona Shaw and Associates. No, but seriously, you know, we've covered a lot of information in here. So hopefully the foreign nationals listen to this episode and you know what questions to ask. And if you're an immigration attorney, hopefully you know what situations to think ahead of. You know, do you have a backup to your backup? You know, are you honestly the best attorney for this client to transition from one path to the other? And hopefully that both parties, the client and the attorney, can make a good connection and have a successful case. Because if not, well, you know, it's denial city now, right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
But hopefully this information will help a lot of people. I like to end on a high note, vice denial. So, Mona, Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.